I pulled up to the old house in rural Pennsylvania just as the sun was dipping behind the hills. It was one of those B&Bs that popped up on Airbnb. Charming photos of lace curtains and homemade muffins, promising a cozy weekend getaway from the city grind. My wife, Rosalie, and I needed it bad. Work had been hell for both of us. She was pulling double shifts at the hospital, and I was buried in deadlines. "This looks perfect," Rosalie said as we grabbed our bags, her eyes lighting up at the wraparound porch dotted with rocking chairs. Inside, the place had that antique vibe. Polished wood floors, floral wallpaper, and, yeah, a whole wall of creepy porcelain dolls staring down from shelves in the parlor. Their glassy eyes followed you, but I shrugged it off. "Dolls are a thing in old houses," I muttered to Rosalie. The owner, this guy named Harold, greeted us at the check-in desk. He was in his late 50s, balding with a perpetual half-smile that didn't reach his eyes.
"Welcome, folks. Room's upstairs. Breakfast at 8 sharp.
His voice was gravelly, like he'd smoked a pack a day since Nixon. We hauled our stuff to the second floor. The room was cute. Beautiful bed, quilt that smelled like lavender, a little ensuite bathroom with clawfoot tub. Rosalie flopped onto the mattress. "Finally, some alone time." She winked, and I felt that familiar spark. After unpacking, she headed for the shower. I scrolled through emails on my phone, trying to unwind. Suddenly, something caught my eye. Scratches on the hardwood floor near the bookcase, like it'd been dragged back and forth.
"Wait, babe, hold up," I whispered, sitting up. Rosalie frowned.
"What? Don't tell me you're thinking about work." I shook my head and got up to inspect. The bookcase wobbled when I pushed it, definitely not fixed to the wall. With a shove, it swung open like a door, revealing a narrow passage. "Holy shit," I said. Rosalie wrapped the towel tighter.
"What the hell is that?"
We peered in, a cluttered room with a desk, ancient computer, stacks of papers, and junk everywhere. It smelled musty, like old books and dust. I marched downstairs to find Harold polishing a doll in the parlor. "Hey man, what's with the secret door in our room?" I asked, trying to sound casual. He set the doll down, that weird smile creeping back.
"Oh, that? Yeah, it's functional. Leads to my office."
He ambled upstairs with me like it was no big deal and demonstrated. The door creaked open from our side. No handle, just a push. On his side, a deadbolt lock.
"See? Secure as can be."
"Is there a lock on our side?" I pressed, my gut twisting. He chuckled, low and throaty.
"No, sir. But don't you worry. We respect privacy here."
His eyes lingered a beat too long on the rumpled bed, where Rosalie stood in her towel, arms crossed. I felt my face heat. "You didn't think to mention a hidden entrance to our room? That's kind of fucked up." Harold just smiled wider.
"Old house, full of surprises. Built in the 1800s. Secret passages for the Underground Railroad, they say. Adds character."
He backed out, still grinning.
"Sleep tight."
Rosalie and I exchanged looks. "This is creepy as hell," she said once he was gone. "What if there are cameras, or he sneaks in?"
"No way we're staying vulnerable," I replied.
That night, passion killed, we barricaded the bookcase with a chair and our suitcase. I barely slept, jumping at every creak. Rosalie tossed too.
"I feel like we're being watched," she whispered around 2 a.m.
Morning came slow. Over breakfast, stale muffins and weak coffee, Harold chatted about local history.
"Those dolls? Family heirlooms. Each has a story."
Rosalie forced a smile.
"Fascinating. Hey, mind if I grab some fresh air?"
While she wandered, I stalled Harold with small talk.
But Rosalie slipped upstairs, curiosity burning. She texted me, "Pushing the door open now." My heart pounded. She came back, pale. "You won't believe this." In the office, amid the clutter, she'd found a notebook. Sketches of guests, detailed notes on couples. "Like he was studying us," she said. But then, the twist. Flipping pages, she uncovered old photos and letters. Harold's wife had died years ago in that room. Suicide, hidden by the family. The office was her old study. He'd sealed it off, but kept the door for visits. The dolls? Hers. The notes? Therapy journaling about grief, mistaking guests for echoes of his lost life. We confronted him. "Why the secrets?" Rosalie demanded. Tears welled in his eyes.
"Didn't want to scare folks away. This place is all I got left of her."
His creepy vibe? Social awkwardness from isolation. No cameras. Just a broken man. We checked out early, but not before Rosalie hugged him. "Get help, Harold. Talk to someone." Driving away, she squeezed my hand.
"That was wild, but I'm glad we know the truth."
This story is inspired from a real-life event shared by one of my subscribers. This is what he said. "We booked a cozy-looking B&B in Pennsylvania. Charming at first glance, aside from a strange wall of antique dolls in the main lounge. Things got weird once we were in our room. I noticed marks near a bookshelf, and after some poking around, found it concealed a door. I asked the owner, who already felt off, if it worked. He grinned and led me through to their messy office. There was a lock on their side. When I asked if it could be locked from our side too, he just smiled and said no. Needless to say, that night we kept the lights low, skipped any intimacy, because, you know, cameras, and shoved furniture against the secret door. Barely slept a wink. I was on a road trip with my best friend, Mia. We were somewhere deep in Texas, that stretch of nowhere between El Paso and Austin. Dusty skies, endless roads, and a motel with three working lights on its sign that just read, "Hotel." But it had decent reviews in our old guidebook, and for $50 a night, we weren't going to be picky. We checked in around 7 p.m. The owner, short guy, bald patch, oily skin, barely looked up from his TV. The place was run down, but clean enough. Faded carpet, musty smell. One of those rooms that feels like it's trapped in a year that doesn't exist anymore. We didn't unpack much. Just showered, ate cold sandwiches, and climbed into bed. I must have drifted off sometime after midnight. The knock on the door came sharp and fast. I jolted up. Mia stirred, still half asleep. "Who the hell?" Another knock, then a voice.
"Hey, this is management. You need to leave. Now."
I opened the door chain and peered out. It was the same guy who checked us in. He wasn't holding anything. No clipboard, no phone, just standing there, sweating.
"You gotta go. I need the room for someone else," he said, eyes darting past me into the room.
"Are you serious?" I asked.
"Dead serious. Got someone waiting. They're paying more."
Mia stepped beside me. His eyes were locked like a magnet. She crossed her arms, suddenly alert.
"This is bullshit," she snapped. "We already paid."
"You'll get a refund,"
he snapped. "No," I said firmly, stepping in front of Mia. "We're not leaving in the middle of the night." He stared at us for a moment, chewing the inside of his cheek, then muttered, "Fine," and stormed off. Or so we thought. 5 minutes later, he was back, loud knocking. This time he was yelling.
"You think I don't know what kind of girl she is?"
he shouted.
"You think I can't tell?"
Mia pushed me aside and stormed out before I could stop her.
"Say that again,"
she yelled. I grabbed my phone and wallet, ready to get the hell out if I had to. But when I looked through the curtain, that's when I saw them. three men, huge. One had a beard down to his chest. They looked like they'd stepped out of an old gang movie. Leather vests, boots, tattoos that didn't stop. They were on the owner in seconds.
"She's paid to be here,"
the tallest one barked.
"You're gonna let her stay tonight."
Another one shoved the guy against the railing.
"We don't want to ever hear shit like this from you again."
"Oh, I don't want any trouble,"
the owner whimpered.
"You already got it."
I stood frozen at the window, heart racing. Mia slipped back inside and locked the door. Her breathing was fast. She didn't say anything, just sat on the bed. A few minutes later, it was dead quiet. I peered out again. The men were gone. The owner, too.
"I don't know what the hell just happened," I whispered.
Mia stared at the door.
"Me neither."
We didn't sleep much after that. The next morning, everything looked normal. The front desk guy, the same one, acted like nothing had happened. Handed us our receipt with a smile.
"Hope you had a pleasant stay," he said.
I stared at him for a second.
"Seriously?"
He blinked.
"Something wrong?"
"No, nothing." To be honest, we weren't able to sleep very well because we were so shook up, but it was better than getting in the car again.
Thank you, anonymous biker gang.
I'd been craving a weekend away from the chaos of my Seattle desk job, so when my friend Jess suggested a girls' trip to a quaint bed and breakfast in the middle of nowhere, Washington, I jumped at the chance. The Shady Haven B&B had glowing reviews online. Cozy, charming, run by a young couple named Leela and Ethan, who looked like they'd stepped out of a fitness magazine. The photos showed pristine rooms with plush bedding and rustic decor, all nestled in a forested valley. Seemed like the perfect escape. Jess and I booked a three-night stay, expecting a relaxing retreat. We couldn't have been more wrong. The drive to Shady Haven was long, winding through dense pine forests and past crumbling barns. When we arrived, the house was stunning. Leela greeted us at the door, her blonde hair pulled into a tight ponytail, her smile almost too perfect. Ethan stood behind her, all chiseled jaw and piercing blue eyes, offering a firm handshake. They were both in their late 20s, fit and polished in a way that made me feel a little self-conscious in my yoga pants and hoodie.
"Welcome, ladies," Leela chirped, her voice syrupy sweet. "We're so thrilled to have you. Let's get you settled."
She led us inside where the air smelled of lavender and cedar. The interior was as gorgeous as the photos. Polished hardwood floors, vintage furniture, and fresh flowers on every surface. But as we followed her up the creaking stairs, I noticed small signs taped to nearly everything. "Do not touch the vase. Do not move the chair. Do not open this drawer." It was odd, but I brushed it off. Some people are just particular about their stuff, right? Our room was a dream, with a massive four-poster bed and a window overlooking the forest. But there was another sign on the nightstand. "No food or drink in rooms. Violators will be charged." Jess raised an eyebrow.
"This place is giving me control freak vibes," she whispered.
I laughed, but an uneasy feeling settled in my stomach. That first night, Leela explained the house rules over dinner. A gourmet spread of roasted vegetables and grilled salmon that almost made up for the weirdness.
"Showers are by request only," she said, her eyes scanning us like she was sizing us up.
"Water's limited out here, so just let us know. Oh, and the Wi-Fi shuts off at 11 p.m. We like to keep things peaceful."
Ethan nodded, his gaze lingering on Jess a little too long. "We check the halls at night to make sure everyone's comfortable," he added. "Safety first." "Check the halls?" Jess asked, her fork pausing midair. "Like, what, you're making sure we're asleep?" Leela laughed, a high tinkling sound.
"Oh, no, just ensuring no one's sneaking around or using the internet after hours. We've had issues with guests before."
The word "issues" hung in the air, but none of us pressed it. After dinner, we retreated to our room, where Jess tried to connect to the Wi-Fi at 10:55 p.m. "It's still on," she said, scrolling through her phone.
let's see how strict they are. At exactly 11 o'clock, the connection dropped. We heard footsteps in the hallway moments later, slow and deliberate. I peeked through the door's peephole and saw Leela's silhouette gliding past, her head turning as if listening for something. My skin prickled. The next morning, we met another guest, a guy named Ryan, in his early 30s, traveling alone. He was friendly, with a scruffy beard and a backpacker vibe. Over coffee, he told us he'd been staying at Shady Haven for a week, working on a novel. "This place is weird as hell," he said quietly, glancing toward the kitchen where Leela was chopping fruit. "Last night, I heard Ethan in my room. I woke up, and he was just standing there, staring. Said he was checking the windows. At 2 a.m.? "That's creepy," I said, my voice low. "Why are you still here?" Ryan shrugged. "It's isolated, cheap, and I need the quiet to write. But yeah, I'm out tomorrow." That day, we explored the nearby trails, but the rules followed us even outside. Ethan caught us taking photos near a pond and snapped, "No pictures of the property!" His tone was sharp, nothing like the charming host from the night before. When we returned, Leela was waiting, her arms crossed. "You didn't ask to use the shower," she said, her smile gone. "There's a $50 fee for that." "For a shower?" Jess scoffed. "You've got to be kidding." "It's in the fine print," Leela said coldly. "Pay up or we'll add it to your final bill." We paid, but the whole thing felt like a shakedown. That night, the footsteps came again, heavier this time. I woke up to see the doorknob jiggle slightly, but no one entered. Jess whispered, "I'm freaking out. This place isn't right." By the third day, we were ready to leave. Ryan was checking out too. But when we went downstairs at 9:45 a.m., we found him standing outside in a torrential downpour, his bags at his feet. Leela stood at the door, arms folded. "Checkout's at 10 sharp," she said. "No exceptions." "It's a thunderstorm," I protested. "You're making him stand out there?" "He should have planned better," Leela said, her voice flat. "Taxi's on its way." Ryan looked furious but didn't argue. As we packed, another guest, an older woman named Carol, rushed into the foyer, her face pale.
"They took my bags," she cried. "I went to town to get cash for the bill, and now they won't give them back."
Ethan appeared, holding a duffel bag.
"You'll get it when you pay," he said, his tone menacing. "No one leaves without settling up." I exchanged a look with Jess. This wasn't just bad hospitality. This felt like extortion.
When it was our turn to check out, Leela stormed into our room without knocking.
"It smells awful in here," she said, wrinkling her nose.
She flung open the window, letting in a gust of damp air.
"You've been eating in here, haven't you? That's another fee. Pay now." "We didn't eat anything," Jess snapped. "This is ridiculous."
Leela's eyes narrowed.
"Cash or card. Now."
We paid, if only to get out of there. As we handed over the money, Leela's demeanor shifted back to saccharine.
"Did you enjoy your stay?"
she asked, smiling like nothing had happened. "Yeah, it was a nightmare," I muttered, grabbing my bag. That's when we noticed Ryan was gone. His taxi had come and gone, but his backpack was still by the door. "Where's Ryan?" I asked. Leela's smile didn't waver.
"He left. Said he was in a hurry."
Something about her tone made my stomach twist. We loaded our car and drove away, but I couldn't shake the feeling that something was wrong. A week later, I saw the news article online. Missing hiker in Washington State. Ryan's face stared back at me. He'd never made it to his next destination. I called the police, sharing everything. The rules, the fees, the nighttime checks, Ethan's creepy behavior. They investigated, and what they found was chilling. Leela and Ethan had been running a scam, overcharging guests and holding their belongings hostage. But it went deeper.
Ryan's backpack, found in a shed behind the B&B, contained a hidden pocket with cash and a flash drive. The drive had photos of Leela and Ethan with stacks of money and what looked like stolen IDs from other guests. The police suspected they'd been targeting solo travelers, robbing them, and worse. Ryan wasn't the first to disappear. The plot twist came when they arrested Leela. Ethan had vanished, leaving her to take the fall. She claimed he'd been the mastermind, but evidence showed that she'd been luring guests with fake reviews, knowing their isolated location made it easy to control them. Ryan's body was later found in the forest. His death ruled a homicide. The police believed Ethan had killed him after Ryan confronted them about the scam. This story has been inspired from a real-life story shared by one of our subscribers. This is what they said. During our stay at a Scottish Island B&B run by a couple, the rooms were stunning but covered with do-not-touch signs. Shower use required permission, and Wi-Fi cut off at 11 p.m. The hostess patrolled the halls at night, checking if guests were asleep and not using the internet. Upon checkout, she entered our room, complained we quote-unquote smelled, flung open a window, and demanded immediate payment. Another guest was evicted at 10 a.m. sharp and forced to wait in a thunderstorm for their taxi. One traveler had to fetch a check from a remote location to pay, only for the hostess to hold their bags hostage. Yet, as we left, she cheerfully asked if we enjoyed our stay. In the sleepy town of Willow Creek, Nebraska, where cornfields stretched like golden oceans under the endless Midwest sky, strange things didn't happen often. Folks there prided themselves on knowing everyone's business. Who was baking pies for the church potluck? Whose kid was skipping school? Or which farmer was feuding over fence lines? So, when Dr. Elias Harper, the town's only dentist for the past 20 years, opened his clinic doors one crisp autumn morning in 2018, he didn't expect the couple who strolled in like they owned the place. The husband and wife were a sight, dressed in those absurdly long white coats that dragged on the sidewalk, embroidered with dentist in bold red letters on the pocket. They looked like they'd stepped out of some old vaudeville act. But there was something polished about them, too polished for Willow Creek. The wife, a woman in her mid-30s with fiery red hair tied up in a messy bun and lips painted with a daring scarlet, carried her opaque toolbox with a confident sway. Her husband, tall and lanky with a mustache that curled at the ends, lugged his own box, grinning like he just won the lottery. The waiting room was buzzing as usual. Mrs. Jenkins nursed a toothache in the corner, flipping through a dog-eared magazine, while the young Tommy Ellis fidgeted next to his mom, dreading his cavity fill. Elias, a widower in his 50s with salt-and-pepper hair and a sensible button-down shirt tucked into khakis, glanced up from his reception desk. His receptionist, Betty, was out sick, so he was pulling double duty. "Can I help you folks?" Elias asked, adjusting his glasses. The wife flashed a megawatt smile, her teeth gleaming unnaturally white.
"Oh, absolutely, Doctor. I'm Dr. Lila Voss, and this is my husband, Dr. Marcus Voss. We're dentists, just like you. We've been traveling the country, building practices in big cities, Chicago, Denver, even L.A., but we're looking to settle down in a charming spot like this. We'd love to join your team."
Elias raised an eyebrow. He'd never advertised for help. His practice was steady, but solo.
"Well, that's flattering, but I'm not exactly hiring. Business is good, but it's just me here."
Marcus leaned in, his voice smooth as silk.
"Come on, Doc. We've got skills that could take this place to the next level. Think about it. More patients, shorter wait times. We've turned floundering offices into gold mines. Let us show you what we can do."
The couple exchanged a glance, something sly passing between them. Elias hesitated. He was a cautious man, raised on the values of hard work and trust earned slow.
"All right," he said finally. "Demonstrate your skills and we'll talk. But nothing fancy. A simple checkup or cleaning."
Lila's eyes lit up.
"Perfect. How about a teeth cleaning? You be the patient, Doctor. It'll be quick and painless."
Elias chuckled uneasily, but he led them to the exam room. He settled into the chair, the familiar hum of fluorescent lights overhead. Marcus opened his toolbox first, and instead of tools, out came a vintage record player. He placed the needle down, and soft melodic jazz filled the air, trumpets weaving with piano keys, lulling like a warm blanket. Relaxation music, Marcus explained, helps patients unwind. We find it boosts trust. Elias nodded, his eyelids growing heavy. The music was hypnotic, wrapping around his thoughts.
That's nice,
he murmured, his voice trailing off. Then Lila opened her box. Elias blinked through the haze, expecting scalers and floss. Instead, she pulled out comically oversized pliers that could wrench a tire off a truck, a hammer and chisel straight from a cartoon, and a squirt gun filled with who knows what. His mind fogged. He smiled dopily, eyes glazing over.
What's all that for?
He slurred, but it came out garbled. Lila slipped on a pair of glasses with thick lenses, black swirls etched like spirals on the glass. She leaned over him. She grinned wide, teeth bared in a predatory flash.
Just relax, Doctor. Look right here.
The swirls on her lenses seemed to spin, drawing him in. Elias's reflection in her eyes showed his own pupils mirroring the motion, whirling faster, pulling him under. His body went limp, mind blank as a fresh snowfall. In the waiting room, patients shifted uncomfortably. Marcus had slipped behind the desk, tapping away at the computer. Next up, Mrs. Jenkins? It'll be $850 for the extraction. Insurance? Oh, we don't take that anymore. Mrs. Jenkins frowned.
But Dr. Harper always...
New policy, Marcus cut in, his mustache twitching. Cash or card? Lila moved on to the first patient, a middle-aged woman named Amy, who'd come for a routine filling. Amy lay back, uneasy but compliant under the jazz's spell. Lila brandished the massive pliers.
Open wide, darling. This won't hurt a bit. Much.
Amy's eyes widened.
Wait, is that...
But Lila was already at work, yanking with theatrical flair. The tools weren't for real dentistry. They were props in a twisted performance. The couple had honed this scam across states, hypnotized the owner, fleeced the patients, vanished before dawn. Lila reveled in it. The power. The thrill. Growing up in a trailer park outside Omaha, she had learned early that men like Elias underestimated women like her. Her curves were her weapon, her wits the blade. Marcus was the brains, but she was the fire. By noon, the office was in chaos. Patients grumbled as bills skyrocketed. $500 for a cleaning, $1,200 for a checkup. One man, a burly farmer type named Hank, slammed his fist on the desk.
This is robbery! Where's Dr. Harper?
Marcus smiled serenely. He's indisposed. Trust us, we're professionals.
I loved my boyfriend Tony, but he was an absolutely terrible gift giver. For my birthday last year, he got me a weight loss cookbook and an exercise DVD, even though we didn't even have a DVD player. I asked him if he was trying to tell me something with the presents, but he just said that he thought I'd like them. Then for Christmas, he got me a new toaster oven, even though we already had one that worked just fine. It was expensive too. With Valentine's coming up pretty soon, Tony told me that he got me something really special. I tried to get him to tell me what it was because I suspected that he'd gotten me something else that I wouldn't use, but he said that it was going to be a big surprise. When Valentine's finally rolled around, Tony took me to a really nice French restaurant to celebrate. Honestly, the dinner would have been a fine present by itself, but once we were done, he gave me a big smile and asked if I was finally ready for the surprise. I said sure. He took me back to the car and handed me a blindfold. He wouldn't start driving until I put it on. I covered my eyes, and then he started the engine. I could feel the car shake as we sped down the road. We drove for a long time, and Tony kept telling me that we were almost there. Finally, he parked the car. I asked if I could take off the blindfold yet, and he said, almost. He got out of the car and then opened my door. He pulled me out of the car, then grabbed my shoulders and started guiding me somewhere. I tried to think of what kind of surprise he had planned, Judging by the distance, we were probably outside of the city center. Maybe he had taken me to a vineyard for wine tasting, or maybe it was some sort of Airbnb thing. We kept walking until Tony finally stopped. "Can I look now?" I asked again. "Go for it," he said. I could tell from his voice that he was smirking. I pulled off the blindfold. It took me a second to adjust to the light. It was already nighttime, so it was pretty dark. Slowly, I realized that he had taken me into a wooded area. There were no buildings nearby, just a bunch of trees. I started to ask where we were, but then Tony shoved me really hard from behind. I stumbled forward and then started to fall. He had led me to the edge of a cliff. For a long, horrible moment, I fell through the air. Tree branches whacked me all the way down. Then I landed on the hard ground. Pain shot through me and I knew that my leg was broken. A couple of ribs too. I looked up to see Tony staring down at me from the top of the cliff. He was smiling triumphantly. He cupped his hands over his mouth and then shouted down, "Sorry, babe, but I think we should see other people." Then he left. I couldn't believe it. His big surprise was to push me off a cliff in the middle of nowhere and then abandon me. For a second, I thought it was some big joke, but I was so badly hurt, and I could hear his car drive off, leaving me there. The pain was unbearable. I could barely move. There was no way I could climb my way out of there. I was trapped and alone and really, really angry. After 20 agonizing minutes, I was able to tie my shirt around my broken leg. It didn't help the pain, but it stopped most of the bleeding. Then, using a stick as a cane, I started limping through the forest. I'm not sure how long I was out there, but eventually I made it to a creek. I started following it, hoping that it would lead to some houses or road. It took 2 hours and I was so close to death, but eventually, the creek led me to an old trailer in the middle of the woods. The trailer was surrounded by a barbed wire fence with multiple no trespassing signs. Normally, this wouldn't be a place that I'd ever want to visit, but I was desperate. I limped towards the front door. Before I could knock, the door swung open and I was greeted by an old man in a dirty white shirt. He had a rifle and he pointed it right at me. "What do you want?" he growled. I started to answer him, but before I could, I passed out. When I finally came to, I found myself lying on a sofa inside the trailer. The man had brought me inside and tended to my broken ankle. He was trying to pour water into my mouth. Now that I was conscious, he asked me what had happened. I told the man everything. He just listened, his face completely blank. When I was finished, he asked me where I lived. I gave him my address, assuming that he'd take me back home. Then I told him that my boyfriend was still there. I'd rather go to the hospital. He just smiled and said, "Wait right there." Then he left. I didn't understand what he was doing. Was he just leaving me there? I dug into my pockets for a phone, but it had fallen out somewhere in the forest. Then I pushed myself off the couch and tried to find a phone somewhere in the trailer. I couldn't find anything. I just limped back to the couch when the front door swung back open and the man re-entered. He had a big smile on his face and he was hiding something behind his back. "So, your boyfriend tried to kill you," he said. I nodded. "He's tall and blonde, right? With a big nose?" Again, I nodded. "Great," the man said. Then he pulled out the object that he'd kept behind his back and threw it at me. I caught the object on instinct. It took me a couple of seconds to realize that he'd just thrown me Tony's head. It had taken him half an hour to drive back to my house, kill Tony, and then return with his head. Horrified, I tossed the head onto the carpet. The man just smiled at me, waiting for me to thank him. I felt like throwing up. All I wanted was someone to take me to the hospital. I never asked him to commit murder for me. But I can't deny that I was happy too. Tony got what he deserved. "Thank you," I told him. "Now can you please take me to the hospital?" He did. The doctors were able to stitch up my injuries and gave me a cast. I'm still recovering, but at least I don't have to worry about Tony anymore. It turns out that he was the one who got a big surprise this Valentine's.